Today on Against the Grain, while entrepreneurship figures into most histories of the U.S., the centrality of capitalism and class struggle tend to be missing. Hence, as a population, we often have no idea about the enormous conflicts that have taken place in this country. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Steve Fraser joins me to discuss the glaring absences in histories of the U.S. without class struggle. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's often said that we're living through a second Gilded Age, with vast disparities in wealth and power, as in the late 19th century. Few writers have thought more about those parallels as historian Steve Fraser, and how the centrality of capitalism is often de-emphasized or absent from accounts of American history. He's the author of a slew of books, including The Age of Acquiescence, and most recently, Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Struggle in American History, published by Verso. Steve, the antitrust reformer Henry Demarest Lloyd, writing in the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, stated that liberty produces wealth and that wealth destroys liberty. Do you think that's correct? Would you say that liberty has produced wealth and that the latter has destroyed the former?
Yeah, I think it's a fair summation of what's happened over the course of American history. By liberty, Lloyd meant that the free market and freedom more generally in a democratic society provided opportunities for all sorts of people who were not born to wealth or high station in social life to venture out on their own, to innovate, explore, to begin new enterprises. It encouraged that kind of activity, which older societies, more hierarchical and caste-ridden where your social position was fixed from birth, didn't allow. And this did indeed encourage people to produce wealth in various ways. Small businesses, bigger businesses, very big businesses produced immense wealth. And America probably was the fastest growing, wealthiest society ever seen in human history until maybe the Chinese over the last sort of half century or so. It was a remarkable, the 19th century particularly, a remarkable period of economic growth and wealth production. But the second half of that equation is also true, that same wealth destroyed liberty, because as property and wealth became more and more concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, it became possible for the very powerful and wealthy to close down opportunities for others, strivers, small people trying to venture forth from less powerful positions. And that's why you get the anti-monopoly movement, for example, in the late 19th century. Henry Demarest Lloyd was a big proponent of and activist in, to break up the great combines in the economic life of the country, whether that was Rockefeller's oil producing or Carnegie steel making and so on, which discouraged liberty and did more than discourage economic liberty. It also discouraged political liberty and democracy, because as this wealth became more and more powerful economically, it also became much more powerful politically in our ostensibly democratic system, where increasingly, and we're familiar with this today, money talks. And these people, these big industrialists and financiers and landowners and so on, enormous political power, not only in the federal government in Washington, but in state governments and local governments. I mean, we see this today, but it was true to begin with back in the 19th century, and that destroyed or helped undermine, if not destroy entirely, liberty and democracy in the political realm as well as in the economic realm.
Well, why is it that those questions around wealth and power, those questions of political economy and capitalism, are so missing from most histories of the United States? I mean, certainly, and as you note,
there is a nod to capitalism in the form of the entrepreneurial spirit, but that bigger picture of the inner workings of capitalism, including the centrality of class conflict, tends to be almost entirely missing from those histories. How is that possible, given what you've just said?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one thing to remember is how invested American culture is in the myth of its exceptionalism, that this is, after all, the New World, which right from the beginning, from the earliest colonial settlements and the revolutionary era after that, was dedicated to equality and liberty and democracy, and was a terrain on which those kinds of experiments in freedom could play themselves out, because it was not already a settled hierarchical society like the old world, like Europe was, and people were, in fact, coming to America to escape that kind of hierarchy. And we've had a long infatuation with the notion that long past the time when there was any basis for its truth in believing that America was exceptional, that somehow it was immune to history, that class society could not, would not spring up here. This is a myth, but like all myths, it contains a kernel of truth. Myths don't usually survive unless there's something about them that rings true. And what rang true about that myth was that America was a vast territory, enormously wealthy in resources, in opportunities for people to own their own land for the first time, to develop natural resources, to venture out into the frontier. These are realities. America was a cornucopia. And so the notion that it could transcend class hierarchy and class conflict had some basis in material reality. And America has, long past the time when that was any longer really true, had a vested interest in denying the class realities that, beginning really in the early 19th century, but accelerating in the late 19th century and into the 20th century, was an increasingly class-divided society. And even if it were class-divided, and people sometimes acknowledge that there were moments when class conflict was apparent and even quite violent class conflict, America's by far the most violent society when it comes to historically in working out its class conflicts, that those were aberrations, those moments of whether it's the Homestead strike or the Pullman strike or the gunning down of workers at the steel mills in 1938 in Chicago, whatever it happens to be. People say, well, that those are exceptional things, and the norm for America is a kind of class a peace and stability and even a vanishing away. That another part of the myth is that America was so full of opportunity that even if you were born in a lowly station or born into a proletarian family, America provided you the chance to rise. We have an enormous investment in the notion of social mobility, and there has been a great deal of social mobility in America, but far less than the myth would have it. But the belief in that social mobility, that's the American dream, after all, to move up, also helped to erase the reality of the class reality, hierarchical realities of American life.
Well, let's talk about some dimensions of looking at U.S. history and putting back that conflict and those class divisions. One of the threads that runs throughout U.S. history that often gets short shrift is around debt. And I wondered if you could speak about that, both from above, that is, debt for those on top and debt for those who are below.
Yeah, you know, debt is long predates capitalism, but capitalism doesn't develop without debt. It's on the basis of credit and debt that people are able to, from the smallest scale to very large scale enterprises, venture out and take risks and develop enterprises and hope that the success of those enterprises will allow them to liquidate those debts. The difference is that more ordinary working people, say farmers in colonial America or post-colonial revolutionary America, were increasingly in debt to East Coast, especially Boston, merchants and bankers, just in order to keep their heads above water, and because they were producing increasingly for the market. And the market insisted they weren't in control of the prices that the market dictated for their crops. They had to borrow in order to cultivate new land, increasingly to buy machinery. By the time we get to the late 19th century, you have a vast farming population all throughout the Midwest, the Far West, and the South. That is, these are agriculturalists deeply in debt to Eastern banks, and they pay a heavy, heavy price for that debt. If they either make it from year to year, or they can't make it from year to year and experience evictions or a reduction of their status from independent farmers to tenant farmers or sharecroppers, the debt is punishing and threatens to extinguish them as a social class. If, however, you were back in revolutionary America or ever since then, a big businessmen, deeply in debt to, say, big banks, undertaking enormous projects, then the shoe is really on the other foot. It's the banking establishment that has to make sure. We know about this today. After the 2007-2008 crash, we talk a lot, even to this day, of banks being too big to fail. Banks holding enormous liabilities that they've representing loans they've made to various kinds of businesses can't afford, so it's alleged, to see them go under, and they can't afford to allow their biggest, like Trump. Trump is a perfect example of this. Trump has always lived heavily indebted to banks, and for many, many decades, or several decades, they kept him afloat, because if he were to go under, their own liquidity, their own financial viability was threatened. And so it's the difference between being in debt if you're just an ordinary person, say a student or a farmer or a shopkeeper or whatever, and if you're a big merchant or industrialist, is sort of night and day. But in one way or another, debt is essential to keep the arteries of capitalist production and distribution and marketing going. So there was back there used to be debtors' prisons. There always were debtors' prisons in Europe, and there were debtors' prisons in America. But the contrast between the way poor debtors were treated and rich ones is striking. In around the turn of the 19th century, 1800 or so, if you were a small guy, a farmer, or you were a shopkeeper, couldn't meet his debts, and your creditors sued you, you went to jail, and you couldn't get out of jail until you had somehow, while still being in jail, managed to repay your debt. And you lived in squalid conditions, in dungeons with poor food, filth, vermin, and so on. If, however, you were, as for instance, Richard Morris was, one of the founders of, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a big merchant and banker, but found himself in debt. He ended up in debtor's prison as well because he couldn't make good on his debts, but he lived like a king to bring into his cells elaborate furnishings, the best food and wine and so on, and live quite well. But American political elites realized very quickly that debtor's prisons were a bad idea, because if you kept people in prison, they couldn't do business. And America was increasingly dedicated to doing business. And so pretty soon, by the early 19th century, debtor's prisons were eliminated, although even today, poor people can find themselves in jail because they failed to pay some kind of consumer loan.
I'm speaking with Steve Fraser. He's a historian, and he's the author of Mongrel, Firebugs, and Men of Property. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So part of this history of capitalism in the United States is clearly a history of the labor force, the working class, both in work and without. And I wondered if you could tell us about how we should see the question of unemployment as an important part of this history.
Yeah, you know, I think we're so used to talking about or making observations about unemployment and the unemployed that we assume it's been an eternal part of what American society and other societies have had to experience, as if it were a kind of part of economic, a kind of economic nature. But actually, that's not the case. It's capitalism which uniquely produces a problem and a kind of cyclical system of unemployment. What's very interesting about that is that if you look at early America, early 19th century America, when capitalism is only first beginning to get a toehold, much of the economy is still agrarian and self-sufficient, or if not literally self-sufficient, largely so. It's not tied into the marketplace. There's a limited amount of industry. The working classes represent a very small part of the working population. It's more made up of farmers and artisans and apprentices and so on. But as the country industrializes, first in the textile industry and then elsewhere, something strange to the people who are living through it, begins to happen. The capitalist economy is subject, as it still is to this very day, to cyclical ups and downs. And when there's a down, when there's a panic, when there's a recession or depression, suddenly people find themselves without work. Now, that's strange for people 100 years ago and more than 100 years ago, because what capitalism does is produce a dependent population of wage earners. That's unusual in the history of America, of the world. These are people without the means of self-support. They don't have land anymore. They don't have a shop any longer to support their families. They don't maintain sources of food, say gardens, vegetable gardens. They are stripped, that is to say, of the means of producing the wherewithal of their own lives. Therefore, they are dependent on wage labor. They have to get hired by those who own the various means of production. Well, when, for various reasons, those businessmen, those industries, face hard times, they lay off their workforce, fire it, discharge it. And that's a strikingly shocking experience for people, because now they have no way to support themselves. And suddenly the phenomenon of unemployment becomes an urgent and pressing one. And people are both outraged and shocked by what's going on. They hold mass demonstrations. This is 19th century America I'm talking about, demanding that the state, local states, intervene, that enterprises be taken over by governments and run so that people will have work to do. There are, during the Great Depression, the greatest of the 19th century, of 1893-94, there are whole armies of the unemployed that begin to mobilize and march on Washington. Coxey's army is the most famous, but there were 40 of these armies that actually gathered from all parts of the country, demanding that the federal government do something about this. And it's only in the 20th century that we become more accustomed to unemployment. We don't like it, but we think of it as a norm. And in fact, economists talk about a normal rate of unemployment, which, if you think about it, is a kind of oxymoron. Why should there be anything normal about being unemployed? After all, unless you're ill or disabled or whatever, but for people who can work and want to work, why should there be any normal rate of unemployment? And the reason has to do with the vicissitudes and cyclical nature of the capitalist economy. So I think a lot of times historians are perhaps more sensitive to the way things have changed as capitalism has taken root and become the overwhelmingly dominant way of producing our material wherewithal.
And of course, when you have these cycles of greater unemployment, then the question arises, which is not just an economic question, but a political and social question, of what do you do with the people who are without work, and the kind of political threat that they may face?
Yeah, exactly right. That's right. To be unemployed is, of course, not only a threat to their material wherewithal, but it also is a repudiation of the egalitarian ethos that's supposed to inform American life, and it can become a source and has been a source of great social conflict in the country. You know, during the Great Depression of the 30s, I think many of your listeners know, and there were great strikes and labor organizing going on, but in conjunction with them, there were mass demonstrations of the unemployed. Of course, that was the period of the greatest unemployment in American history, but there were mass mobilizations, demonstrations, a famous one, a March of the Unemployed on Henry Ford's Dearborn Works in Michigan, was greeted with violence by his private armies. So it becomes a source of great social conflict, and also begins to insinuate itself. That's probably the wrong word. It begins to occupy a place in the thinking of policymakers, beginning especially with the New Deal. There's some before that, but especially with the New Deal. That's why we get unemployment insurance. That's where it all comes from. That finally there's a recognition by official society that this is apparently a permanent part of life under capitalism, and there has to be some, however minimal, defense against simply being abandoned to without work, and we get you know the Social Security Act, which includes unemployment insurance.
Well, how do elites handle the unemployed workforce when those policies are dialed back, and when there's an attack on that social safety net? In more recent times, starting with the 1970s, obviously you saw a real shift both in the way capitalism was organized, but also how elites chose to respond to unemployment.
Well, I think one of the symptoms of and solutions, if you will, to this unemployment problem becomes mass incarceration. In the period you're talking about, in our lifetimes, in the last part of the 20th century and continuing today, so that what you have are vast populations, largely defined by race, which have become superfluous to the economic workings of especially financially driven capitalism in the late 20th century. And that's an explosive problem and has exploded now and then. And one way, not the only way, but one way you deal with that is mass incarceration, which is an indictment of a society that can't productively employ literally millions of people. I mean, the United States has the highest incarceration rate, I think, of any country in the world, I think, with the exception of Rwanda, per capita. So that is one way. It's collateral to that, is you stigmatize, if you're a policymaking or ruling elite, you stigmatize the unemployed as shiftless, idle, lazy, even inherently so. That's the racial dimension of that. Although, quite frankly, one of the interesting things about, you know, we in the beginning of the 60s and thereafter, American elites talked about the culture of poverty, that people were kind of, and we even have it today, that hillbilly, Hillbilly Elegy, the guy wrote, I forget his name. Anyway, the point is that it's almost inbred in certain cultures. It's almost genetic, but it's culturally genetic. And usually that has been applied to African Americans. And there was a whole literature and debate about the flaws and of the African American family dating to slave days. The interesting thing is, though, that the culture of poverty thinking first arose among policymaking elites and scholars earlier than the 60s, and was applied to Appalachian whites who had moved into the industrial cities of the Midwest, Cleveland, Muncie, Detroit, etc., and were also characterized as shiftless, idle, lazy, no ambition, no discipline, and so on. That culture of that very word, that phrase, culture of poverty, was first used to apply to them. So there's a kind of a tendency to find fault in the victim of this unemployment rather than in the systemic causes of that unemployment. Because to look at that, to look at the systemic causes, is to say there is something fundamentally malfunctioning about this capitalist economy that it can't find employment for so many people.
Historian Steve Fraser is my guest. We'll return with him after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm joined today by Steve Fraser. He is the author of many books of history, including most recently Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Conflict in American History. That's published by Verso at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to his book. Well, Steve, you've written extensively in books like The Age of Acquiescence about the Gilded Age of the late 19th century and our Gilded Age, the era that we're living through. I wonder if you could tell us what you see as the similarities between these two periods of American history, roughly separated by 100 years, and also the differences between the two.
Sure, I can mention a few things. I think the similarities more people are familiar with. And that's why we call our own age a second Gilded Age. There is, first of all, the gross inequality in the distribution of income and wealth, which was characteristic of the first Gilded Age and is characteristic of our own. There is, of course, what they didn't use this phrase then, but the Gilded Age, that phrase comes from a Mark Twain novel, his first best-selling novel that he wrote with somebody else called The Gilded Age. And what he talked about a lot in that book, it's very funny even if you read it today, is what today we would call crony capitalism. That is to say, this incestuous relationship between people of great wealth and the political system, and the way the way wealth undermines and corrupts the political system. And of course, we talk about that today too. So the two Gilded Ages certainly share that. They also share a kind of ideology and a theology. Back in the Gilded Age, first Gilded Age, there was a kind of theological current which talked about that riches, accumulating wealth and riches, was a sign of God's favor. And there was a famous speech given, I think, more than any other speech in American history by a man named Russell Conwell, the founder of Temple University, called Acres of Diamonds, which was a justification of this vast, a theological justification of this vast inequality. And today we have the gospel of prosperity, which does something like that. There's also the ideological justification back in the 19th century. It was called social Darwinism, which alleged to prove that Darwin's theory of evolution operated also in human society, and that the fittest in human society survived. The fittest were clearly those who proved their fitness by triumphing in the marketplace, and that was in fact a social benefit because it would weed out the less fit. Today we talk about meritocracy. It's a kindred kind of defense, ideological defense of great inequality. So those are some of the clearest, I think, similarities between the two Gilded Ages. But I have always been struck by the differences. And one I just alluded to in a way when we were talking about unemployment. You know, in the first Gilded Age, poverty had everything to do with exploitation at work. And maybe we're not, but many of us are familiar with what it was like to work 12 hours a day in a Carnegie steel mill, or at least we've heard stories about it, what it was like to work in the textile, in the garment industry, in the sweatshops of the garment industry, and so on. Among other things, you did, though, it was exhausting, dangerous, and paid very badly. So you struggled to survive. But poverty in our own age, and the unemployment thing we talked about a little while ago, illustrates that, is more about not but about poverty because you're excluded from work. It's the exclusion from work, not the exploitation at work. I quickly should add that we also have a vast population of the working poor today. So I don't mean to say that exploitation at work somehow came to an end in the Second Gilded Age. It didn't. But poverty, nonetheless, is still tied to a lack of work today, unlike an earlier time. But I think the biggest difference, I don't want to go on too long, the biggest single difference that I have spent a lot of time writing about is that during the First Gilded Age, there was enormous resistance to what then, not now, but then, was a new system, a new way of life called capitalism. And all of its iniquities, its inequities, its cataclysmic effect on natural life, on daily life, all of this was new, and it made people feel the precariousness of their lives. It left them poor, and it destroyed. So my point is that it generated an enormous resistance to this new capitalism. That resistance took many forms: the anti-monopoly movement, the Knights of Labor, labor movement of the 1880s and 90s, the populist movement, of course, that swept through America and elected all kinds of congressmen and governors and local officials, the socialist movement, the syndicalist. In other words, it generated a whole bevy of resistances, and on the cultural level too, novelists, journalists, even presidents could sometimes inveigh against this new capitalist order, its trustification, the way wealth was corrupting the country, and so on. That until recently, that was not typical of our second Gilded Age. We lived all through the 80s and 90s, 1980s, 1990s, well into this new century of ours, with, by comparison, very little resistance, even as the inequities were noticed by people, written about in newspapers and so on. The working poor grew, the mass incarceration was there, the gross inequalities in the distribution of income and wealth was there, and yet there was very little, relatively speaking, I don't mean there was none, but relative to what went on in the 19th century and into the Great Depression, which is what the culmination of that resistance, there was very, very little, and I've spent some time trying to figure out why that was the case. But I should say now, recently, since the 2007-08 Great Recession, there is more and more evident, obviously evident, resistance to what is going on, what has been going on in this Second Gilded Age.
Well, tell us why you think that that striking difference has come to pass, that until recently there really has not been wide-scale resistance to a society that has become increasingly unequal, increasingly oppressive. How has the acquiescence that you've written about been generated?
Well, it's a complicated question. I don't know that I know all the answers. One thing is you can cite various factors. I think one is the advent of a kind of mass consumer culture, which really doesn't grip America fully until the post-World War II era. And it becomes a place where the old promise of reinventing yourself by the American dream, which used to have something to do with getting a piece of land of your own or a small business of your own, moving up the social ladder, becomes instead, since the condition of wage labor has now become permanent and the overwhelming condition of most people, consumer culture offers a series of realities and fantasies that encourage the notion of self-invention and upward, at least mobility, or if not upward, social mobility, a kind of gratification, which eschews collective efforts. It's very fragmenting. It's very individual. You live out that consumer dream by buying a host of this and that, and it has nothing to do with kind of collective resistance to what may otherwise be happening. I think the virtual, if not destruction, the withering away and the assault on the labor movement in the last really almost half century now has been a major factor in undermining resistance. And this was a concerted effort by particularly the Republican Party, beginning with Ronald Reagan, really, with the air traffic controllers, the breaking of the air traffic controller strike in 1981, as soon as he took office, and has continued ever since in whittling away the protections the labor movement had achieved during Roosevelt's New Deal, so that the Wagner Act is barely worth the paper, which is the National Labor Relations Act, is barely worth the paper it's written on. All kinds of activities by employers that used to be considered unfair labor practices no longer are. In a thousand ways, the labor movement has been placed on the defensive. The outsourcing of industry to the global South has not only deindustrialized America, and by deindustrializing America, destroyed the wherewithal, the tissues of resistance, not only the unions, but the whole communities in which those unions thrived. So that you have these industrial ghost towns, which used to be powerful centers of social resistance, they're evacuated. They've been cleansed of all that, and nothing's left in many of them. So the destruction, the abandonment by the Democratic Party of working people, you know, it's the abandonment of its New Deal commitments to doing something for ordinary working Americans, which was so much important part of the New Deal. And indeed, the New Deal is unimaginable without the robust participation of a powerful organized labor movement. Well, beginning with, let's say, Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council, even before he became president, the Democratic Party, hoping to duplicate the Reagan victory by adopting a free market ideology, became less and less interested in defending the labor movement and the social safety net, bought into the whole free market ideology, I think Hillary Clinton reaped the final price of that in her defeat three years ago. So those are some of the reasons why I think this acquiescence settled over the country and has lasted until fairly recently.
What do you think of the role of race and racial resentments in keeping the working class divided and not united against the elites?
Yeah, I think it's extremely, obviously, central to this story. I mean, what we see today in the triumph of Trump is the triumph of something that began, racial prejudices have always existed in America. But what I'm talking about right now, the triumph of Trump originates with Nixon's strategy in the 1968 election to invoke the silent majority, the Republican Party had up until that time been mainly a party of business, middle-class folks, farmers, the more prosperous parts of the population. The Southern strategy and the silent majority were designed to appeal to a much more blue-collar audience, white, though, a white blue-collar audience that resented the fact that all the that the war on poverty, et cetera, all the efforts to rectify some of the inequities that afflicted African Americans were coming at their expense. You know, whether that was through affirmative action or whatever the particular policy was, Nixon and that Republican strategy played on those resentments, those fears, and the justified feelings that they were being overlooked, and they were being overlooked. We're talking about poor working class communities in Boston, for example, or in Philadelphia, various cities around the country, who also are suffering the early signs, and then later on the very severe signs of deindustrialization, lack of work, and so on, and blame that on a kind of liberal elite that only cares about this black population and its policy designed to help them. And I think initially with Nixon and Reagan and so on, this silent majority stayed silent. It could be manipulated. It could be used to attack Democratic Party elites as elitists, and there was some justification for that charge. Meanwhile, serving the needs basically of corporate America and so on, and throwing kind of cultural tokens to this blue collar world by way of whether it was about cultural issues or whatever. I think what happened in our more recent past is that silent majority found its own voice, and you first got the Tea Party, and then you got this kind of right wing populism, which was avowedly anti-elitist. Remember, when the Tea Party begins, it's denouncing the bank bailouts by the Bush administration, and then later by Obama, as well as denouncing inveighing against same-sex marriage and abortions and so on. It's also very avowedly anti-elitist, and it's increasingly attacking RIMBYs, Republicans in name only, rhinos, because they're at odds with that more elite section of the Republican Party, which had brought them into being in Nixon's years, and they become the center of gravity of the Republican Party. Trump plays to that. He's a kind of populist plutocrat. You know, he comes from, and really in the end is only interested in making money for himself and people like himself, but he became masterful at summoning up the resentments of this now not voiceless but very loud right-wing populist insurgency.
Historian Steve Fraser is my guest. He's the author of Mongrel, Firebugs, and Men of Property. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you are a historian of the United States, and obviously the U.S. has a long history of populism, taking different forms in different times. But how do you, so maybe this is not a fair question to you, but how do you see the appeal of what you're calling populist plutocracy in the United States in the context of that kind of politics appeal more broadly in other regions of the world?
Yeah, well, it's a fair question. I don't know how much I can say beyond what you just said. Clearly, the breakdown of this long period of neoliberal hegemony in the United States and in Europe is evident, and various kinds of right-wing populism have developed pretty much every place, and not just in Europe, but in Bolsonaro in Brazil and so on, various other South American countries. You see it virtually in every European country. And I think what happened here is that for a long, long time, the policymaking elites, both in the economic and political realm in the West, simply ignored the fact that the system they were presiding over was increasingly a punishing one for the working classes of these societies, and that they were not, and that they, either they were not addressing or didn't know how to address those needs. All of them experienced periods of severe austerity. We certainly did in the United States, which were further punishing to those working populations. They also, were either deaf, dumb, and blind, or didn't care about the fact that the outsourcing of production to the global south meant that their home economies were more and more hollowed out when it came to good paying unionized jobs. This phenomenon in the United States has been repeated in England, for example. I'm sure we've all been reading about how Northern England became this pro-Brexit, even in Labour Party strongholds, became and did in this election indeed become a Brexit stronghold, because these places have been, like many places, like say, Youngstown, Ohio, they have become places that were destroyed by this neoliberal, financially driven form of capitalism that has presided over life for the last 40 years or more. So I think a lot, and of course the similarities extend to a kind of politics of resentment directed against the weak. You know, a lot of these populisms are anti-elitist, but they rarely take on the elites. And when it comes to taking on somebody, they choose those more vulnerable than they, whether that's immigrants in Europe or racial minorities in the United States, and so on. It's a classic kind of scapegoating, proto-fascist kind of way of dealing with things. And, it's hard to know what will come. It's very dangerous times to be living in. Trump embodies that danger clearly, I think, to most people, or many people. And it's hard to know which way things will develop. I think one of the interesting things of recent political life in the United States is that phenomenon of people who voted, working people in some of these key states, what do they call them, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera.
Swing states.
People who voted twice for Obama in 2008 and 2012 and voted for Trump in 2016. What that says to me is that although there clearly is a racial component to this right-wing populism, it's a mistake to think you've solved that problem or understood it by in those terms alone. Because these folks voted for a black guy, and it's pretty, in America, that's like almost, for me as a young man, that was unimaginable that could ever happen in America, and then voted for Trump. So they weren't responding. It's hard to argue that they were responding to Trump's explicit racism, but to other things: his irreverence, his denunciation of elites, his apparent concern for working people, his promise of jobs, all this kind of, bringing back American industry, all that kind of thing. It's toxic, but it's complicated, and it means that that population may be up for grabs in the future and should not be dismissed as irretrievably right-wing and racist and so on.
You point out that Trump was inaugurated on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation and the centenary of the Russian Revolution, which, you might just say, well, accidents of history and calendar. But how do you see where we are now with Trump within that larger arc of history?
Well, it's a grim picture. I mean, both of those great moments in European history, and really in a way in world history, certainly, the Reformation and the Bolshevik Revolution, despite all the contradictions that one can mention about those events or those moments, they, in the end, were part of the longer story of liberation, whether that's liberating the liberating of conscience, of religious belief, of a personal relationship to God, to challenging, as Luther did, the powers that be which were then, of course, ensconced in the Catholic Church, or whether it was taking on capitalism and imperialism, as the Bolshevik Revolution did, promising to emancipate the working class, no matter what may have happened after 1917. That was the great hope of the Bolshevik Revolution. And one might say that, well, there was an arc that, as Martin Luther King says, that bends towards justice. Well, I don't really believe that, but you could make that case. It's harder now to make that case. And I'm not naive. Obviously, the Bolshevik Revolution turned into a nightmare. Luther was as repressive as any church hierarch when it came to the peasant revolts that accompanied the revolution and so the Reformation and so on. But the arc seems to me to be there. It led to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, etc. You come to Trump, and it is the kind of nihilistic triumph of a kind of amoral capitalism. See, Trump, in my view, doesn't have any beliefs. He doesn't really believe in anything. He's not like a right-wing ideologue. He does what works. He's amoral, like capitalism. Capitalism is not immoral. It's just amoral. It's all about the bottom line. Whatever works is good. And Trump is that kind of, you look into his eyes and you look into the abyss of a kind of amoral capitalism, first, last, and always, willing to do whatever it takes, and brutal, brutish and brutal in his sensibilities and his character.
We have to leave it right there. Steve Fraser, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Mongrel Firebugs and Men of Property, Capitalism and Class Conflict in American History. That's published by Verso. You can find a link to our website, to that book, on our website, againstthegrain.org. His other books include The Age of Acquiescence and The Limousine Liberal. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.